Agreement, which provides for us to have unified engagement in trade negotiations. So, Mr. Chair, that is then the basis for all the negotiations that we need to engage in. In terms of the third round to the SAE-EU nations, the economic partnership agreement is not a new trade agreement in terms of our trade with the EU. We are building on the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement, which was signed by South Africa and the EU. The bilateral agreement between South Africa and the EU signed on the 11th of October in 1999. And it is a trade chapter in the TDCA because it broadly covers our development cooperation with the EU. But there's a trade chapter, and that trade chapter is what has, since 1999, informed how trade with the EU. So the EPA is an addition or is building from the TDCA. And the TDCA, Honorable Chair, was the first comprehensive trade agreement that South Africa completed with a developed country. And it allows for asymmetry so that we take into account the differences in levels of development between the EU as well as South Africa. So in terms of the asymmetry, South Africa liberalized much lesser than the EU and took longer to implement its obligation. So we committed to grant basically access to 86% of EU imports and we liberalized for 12 years, while the EU liberalized 95% of South Africa's imports over a shorter period, which is 10 years. So for the EU, the TDPA was fully implemented in 2010, and for South Africa, we fully implemented our obligations in 2012. So given that it did not cover all the tariff lines, what the TDPA did is to ensure that we protect our sensitive sectors, which includes clothing and textiles. It includes some industrial tariff lines so that we can advance our industrial development. And in some cases, we didn't provide any preferences to the EU, or in some cases, we only provided a marginal preference. So a marginal preference means that we're not saying we're going to give them job duty. We can say we're giving them 10% if the most favored nation rate is 20%, for example. So it gives them a marginal preference. What was of concern to us, Honorable Chair, was that when we implemented the TDPA, it became clear that there were some negative implications for South Africa's policy space in a number of areas, which we sought to resolve through the negotiation of the Economic Partnership Agreement, but I will cover those issues in detail in the later slides. But also important to note, is that there was uneven market access in agriculture. In agriculture, we did not get as much as they wanted into the EU market, while we gave them a lot of access into our market. Mm-hmm. So what that resulted to was that we were receiving a lot of pressure in terms of losing competitiveness in the agricultural sector, and it put our agricultural sector under severe pressure. So in engaging in the Economic Partnership Agreement, we tried to resolve all of those imbalances. In terms of the trade figures, the EU remains South Africa's main trading partner. Total trade increased from 374 billion in 2011 to 536 billion in 2015. So over that period, we saw a 43% increase in trade. So in a way, the TDCA has been beneficial to both parties. South African exports and imports with the EU experienced an annual growth of about 9% during the period. In terms of our own exports, now not looking at total trade, but South Africa's exports into the EU, we were able to increase our exports from 151 billion in 2011 to 216 billion in 2015. If you look at that, because the total trade is 536, while we are exporting 216 billion. So what it means is that the trade is in favor of the EU. But there has been growth in total trade by 257% since the agreement was implemented in 2000. What the EFTA has done, because one of the key objectives that we outlined in the trade policy strategic framework is that we want to change the structure of trade with our trading partners. And also ensure that we are able to diversify the trading partners, but also diversify the export basket. So the TDCA has successfully assisted us to do that. Even though South Africa still mainly exports primary products, we have seen that there are manufactured products that are in the top 10 products that we export to the EU. In terms of the top 10 products, the key ones are platinum, ferroalloys, coal, and iron ore. And in terms of the share or their contribution to our exports, the platinum contributes 7.2%, ferroalloys 4.8%, coal 2.6%, and iron ore 3.1% in 2015. As I said, Honorable Chair, we have also seen growth in manufactured exports. We have motor cars being the key manufacturing exports that we export to the EU, including motor vehicles for transport. And the motor cars contributed, both of them contributed 1% to our total export to the EU. In terms of agricultural exports, the key ones are grapes, citrus, as well as wine. Now, if I come to the economic partnership and negotiation. The EU negotiated with Africa, Caribbean, as well as Pacific on the 27th of November 2002, the Economic Partnership Agreement. The aim was to replace the unilateral trade regime that the ACP had with the EU. We had the Cotonou Partnership Agreement at that time, and it had to replace the Lomé Convention. South Africa was part of the Lomé Convention in 1997 and also part of the Cotonou Partnership Agreement. But we were excluded from the unilateral trade region, so we're not participating in the trade chapter of the Cotonou Agreement, which is why we had to negotiate trade agreement with the EU, because we're not receiving any preferential treatment when it comes to trade. So it was not that South Africa would have wanted to negotiate a reciprocal trade agreement with a developed country, but we were forced by circumstances because we are excluded from the trade chapter. And in negotiating the EFTAs with the continent, the EU came up with its own configurations under which it would want to negotiate the Economic Partnership Agreement. The concern, if you recall, honourable members from the continent, was that the EFTA configurations were not fitting neatly to the regional economic community that we have established for ourselves in the continent. And it meant that now with the EFTA configurations, we were in a way undermining regional economic integration in the continent. So in terms of SADC, SADC was broken up into three groupings. It was the SADC EFTA group, which consisted of Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, Swaziland, and Tanzania. It was the EAC group, which includes the EAC countries, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. And it was the EFTA group, Eastern Southern Africa, which includes the rest of SADC that are not covered by the SADC EFTA group. Tanzania then decided to join the EAC, so the EFTA group, SADC EFTA group, then consisted of Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, and Switzerland. So it's SACU plus Angola and Mozambique, basically. Initially, we were not part of the negotiations because the EU felt that there was already an existing trade agreement with South Africa through the TPCA, so we participated in the SADC EFTA negotiations. as an observer, because for us, we felt it necessary to observe those negotiations so that we can safeguard the regional economic integration agenda. But it became clear, as we were participating as an observer, that the BLNS, mainly the SACU countries, will be taking commitments that are different to South Africa vis-à-vis the EU, which would have put into jeopardy the integrity of a common external tariff in SACU. So really, we then decided in 2007 to participate fully as active participants in the negotiations. And our core interests were to harmonize the trade regime between the EU and SACU and present the common external tariff, to secure fair market access in agriculture beyond what we had achieved in the TTCA, because as I've said at the beginning, there was uneven market access in agriculture. Thirdly, we wanted to claw back for some of the policy gains that we lost under the TTCA. Now, in terms of the implications of the EFA, through our participation as active partners in the EFA negotiations, we have ensured that the SACU common external tariff is maintained and that there is a uniform trade regime between the EU. And also, we have been able to address some of the shortfalls that we experienced as a result of the TTCA. With regard to the TGCA, we liberalize more lines in comparison to the EU as I've indicated, but also importantly, which was an anomaly in the TGCA, we agreed to a standstill clause, which means that if we are increasing the most favored nation rate, which is a rate that we charge from goods that are coming from anyone that we do not have a trade agreement with, what that would have meant is that even on tariff lines where we have not included them under liberalization under the TGCA, we're not able to increase those tariffs vis-à-vis the EU. So in a way, that would have, that meant that we had committed to 100% of the tariff lines, even though the agreement was 85%, because on the 15% that is not part of the trade agreement, even though we are below our buying rebound rate, vis-à-vis the EU, we're not able to increase those tariffs, which as I said was a bit of an anomaly. But also with the safeguard provision, the safeguard is a trade measure that is implemented by a country and it's in line with the WTO provisions that if a country experiences the current surge in imports that is harming its industry, then a country can impose a safeguard measure. But under the TDCA, that safeguard provision was only available to us for 5 years, which limited our policy space in terms of ensuring that we are able to safeguard our own interests. Also importantly, we eliminated the use of export taxes, except for those that were in place at the time, which only related to diamonds. So what that means is that we lost the policy space to beneficiate, or we lost the policy space to use an instrument that will assist us to beneficiate our own product and community industrial development. So those were the key concerns that we had going into the negotiation. In terms of market access, we have been able to improve market access mainly on agriculture because of this duty-free, quota-free access on the agriculture, I mean on the non-agricultural market line, the industrial tariff line. So in terms of the outcome of negotiations, we've improved market access on fishery products. We have also improved market access on 32 agricultural products. We have also managed to get new market access in terms of sugar. We have a quota of 150,000 tons. On ethanol, it's a quota of 80,000 tons. We also have received an improvement in the quota for wine. We've been able to more than double that from 50 million liters to 110 liters. We also have improved preferences on flour, sanitary products, fruit products, as well as canned fruits. In terms of the textual provisions, as I indicated, honourable members, one of the critical issues that we want to advance in the negotiations is to ensure that we promote regional economic integration. We have been able to negotiate better rules of origin that will allow us to cumulate with other countries in the continent. By cumulation, we mean that a product can be sourced from any country in the continent, be beneficiated in South Africa, and still be able to get preferential market access into the EU. So that provision allows us to drive our own agenda of promoting regional industrialization, because one of the critical issues that we highlight as important for regional industrialization is that the development of value chains, which would allow a country that has a comparative advantage in a specific product or specific activity to be able to process those products in the continent. So to the extent of accumulation, we are able to promote intra-regional trade as well as promote regional industrialization. Also important, honorable members, is that now we have managed to reverse what we had under the TDCA, where we gave away the policy phase or the policy instrument on export taxes. Now we can introduce export taxes on exports to the EU under certain circumstances. In terms of the standstill clause, it will not apply to products that or tariff lines that have been excluded from the regulation. As I indicated before, it was an anomaly because we also had the standstill clause applying to tariff lines that were excluded from liberalization. So then it means that if we are increasing the MSN rate, we can increase it even on products that apply to the EU as long as they are not part of the trade agreement itself. We also have a provision that allows us to implement bilateral safeguards indefinitely. So it takes away that LTA limitation that we have in the TCCA. We also have an automatic specific agricultural safeguard on an aggregate stock of products on agriculture. The critical issue here is that it was important for us to negotiate this provision because of the pressure that the agricultural sector was experiencing. So with the automatic safeguard, if there is a sudden surge in imports, we can impose a safeguard. Also important is a single stage transformation rule on textiles and clothing, which will provide better market access opportunities for our clothing and textile sector, and it's a sector that we are stabilizing and revitalizing as the department. We also have to negotiate a geographic indications charter. The geographic indications means that if a product has specific quality because it is coming from a specific locality, it is able to be recognized as a product that has a higher quality and is able to attract a higher value in the market. So there is benefit in negotiating the geographic indication names. Again, we are building here on the TDCA because we had the wines and spirits agreement under the TDCA, but it was only covering, as I said, wines and spirits. But now we are covering also agricultural names. In terms of what the protocol covers for South Africa, wine as well as three agricultural products, rooibos, tea, taro lamb, as well as honeybush. Most importantly is that we have negotiated that because the number of our producers that have been using the name are going to be protected under the geographic indication, especially on the agricultural products. So we had to negotiate for coexistence of names, which means that companies that were using the names before the entry into force of the agreement will continue to use those names. But any company that produces those products beyond the entry into force of the agreement, they will have to use a variation of names. For example, feta, then a new company that comes and produces feta cheese will then have to say after the entry into force of the agreement, either it will be feta style or feta type, to ensure that there is differentiation between the actual feta cheese that is produced in the EU and that was produced in South Africa prior to the entry into force of the agreement. In terms of what is covered, the EU will receive protection of names for 251 GI, which includes 120 wines, 5 beers, 20 spirits, and 106 agricultural produce, which includes a number of special meats, cheese, as well as olives. For South Africa, it's 102, and wine, as well as the three agricultural products, your rooibos, as well as carolem. But we also have negotiated a provision to add more additional agricultural names in the future. In terms of the milestones and where we are in the process, the EPA negotiations, as I've indicated, honorable members, started in 2002. South Africa joined in 2007. So throughout those years, we're negotiating the agreement. The negotiations were concluded in 2014. And then on the 15th of July 2014, we initiated the agreement, which signifies the fact that we have concluded the negotiations. After that, we engage in a process of legal scrapping. This is one of the important processes because it takes time to negotiate a trade agreement, and different chapters are negotiated at different times. So it's important to thoroughly go through the agreement once it is concluded to ensure that it crosses all the I's and the T's, and that the spirit of what was negotiated and the outcome of negotiation comes up very clearly in the legal provisions. So that process started in 2014 and we concluded the legal scrapping on the 23rd of October 2015. The EPA was then signed by the parties on the 10th of June 2016 in Botswana in Hassane. Then what is expected is that members must now take the EPA through ratification process. As South Africa, we have concluded our ratification process on the 24th of August 2016. Namibia has also concluded the ratification process, and Botswana does not need to ratify because once they sign, it means they have already followed through their own internal process. So it's only these two that is outstanding now in terms of ratification. After ratification, the agreement will be implemented, and we have, in terms of the agreement, established some institutions that will see to the implementation of the agreement. The country will also undertake public awareness campaigns to ensure that our private sector and exporters are aware of the opportunities that arise out of the EFA. In terms of the way forward, the EU can provisionally apply the agreement while the 38 member states of the EU are taking it through their own approval processes in Parliament, which would allow for implementation of the agreement. What is important is that all the countries, the SADC EPA countries, must ratify the agreement and that it must enter into force on the 3rd of October 2016. The reason for this is that the EU has a market access regulation that would imply that if Botswana, Namibia and Swaziland have not ratified and implemented the EPA by then, they would lose preferential market access into the EU. South Africa is not included in that because we have the TGCA. Lesotho is not included in that because it is the least developed country and is covered by everything but arms agreement with the EU as a least developed country. So the countries that are vulnerable to losing differential market access are the three, which is Botswana, Namibia, and Swaziland. So the aim was that all of us must ratify the agreement so that it can come into force on the 1st of October to safeguard the SACPO and to safeguard the interests of the customs union. I thought I should include honourable members a slide on Brexit and the implications for the EPA, because we concluding this process and we are ratifying the EPA while UK has indicated that it would leave the EU. For South Africa, the UK is the eighth largest trading partner in terms of the 2015 figures. In terms of our exports to the UK, we exported 41 billion rands worth of products, while we imported 35 billion from the UK. So the trade is in favor of South Africa. What is also important is that the trade with the UK is also diversified. and it's also a key market for our agricultural products as well. So it is important to ensure that we keep a preferential arrangement with the UK as a key trading partner. For the UK to officially leave the EU, it will need to invoke Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. And once it invokes Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, it will have to start to negotiate with Brexit, and it must conclude the process within 2 years. What the UK has indicated is that it is not planning to trigger Article 50 before the end of this year. So which means that it is likely that the process to negotiate the exit will only start in 2017. So what does this mean for the EPA? The UK is currently part of the EPA, so the EPA will provisionally enter into force for the UK and will stay in force until the UK has completed its exit from the EU. What we're doing as the department is to engage the UK on a continuous basis so that we can understand the things and also share some perspectives in terms of how we can take up the interests of both parties and ensure that we are able to maintain market access into this important market for South Africa. In conclusion, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, our view as the DGI is that we have an agreement that is beneficial to South Africa. It has assisted us to rectify some of the challenges that we experienced from the TTPA. Most importantly, it has assisted us to continue to advance our regional economic integration agenda and SACU and ensure that as SACU members, we have one trade regime with the EU. Which preserves common external tariffs and preserves the customs union. But also importantly, it has allowed us to enhance the policy space that we lost under the TTPA, and it has also allowed us to improve agricultural market access on key products of interest in South Africa. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mrs. Mlumbi, for your presentation. I want to, can I be advised, do you want to engage the presentation or we should allow Gergot to fill us in, because they said it's just a 5 minute thing that we would like to discuss it. Over to Gergot.
Chair, I just need some technical assistance for moving this slide.
Hey, Daniels.
I'm just looking for technical assistance to find my slide on this machine that the people have set up.
It was really, you were going to miss your bonus. With the presentation, presentation with a passion. That is the thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. The purpose of my presentation is to look at the foreign policy implications.
You have a slide before you, but I will start off on one of the pages further down so that we can just look at the implications. I think page 6 or 7.
Honourable Khalid is one of our most experienced representatives. Mr. Gentleman.
Introduce myself, it's the advocate Mohammed Kassanji Paterko, responsible for this particular item for EPA.
Advocate?
Kassanji, Mohammed Kassanji.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
The EPA will contribute to the promotion of regional integration and will also allow SADC EPA Group to expand its international trade. In this way, Chair, we will contribute to South African foreign policy and to the objectives of the NDP. Furthermore, as we are aware and have mentioned previously by DTI, the South African-European Union relationship is underpinned by the Trade, Development and Cooperation Agreement signed in 1999. The SADC EPA will help us to reinforce South African economic diplomacy strategy to enhance access to markets of the 28 EU member states. For us, I think that's critical in terms of what we're trying to achieve in economic diplomacy, that is through market access. I've put the slide up to give an indication of our trade figures. The total imports for 2015 was 320 billion, total exports was 215 billion, and as mentioned, total trade was 536 billion, and we have a negative trade balance of 104 billion. Regarding the composition of our exports and imports, that was dealt with by the DDG, so I won't go over that, but just to say on the more positive side, some manufactured goods are starting to count among our top SA exports to the EU. As has been mentioned before, South Africa's core interests have been to harmonize trading regime between SAPU and the EU and to secure further market access in agriculture, and as indicated before, to get back on policies paid lost under the TPA. That's important in our trade negotiations. Furthermore, what's important to us, Honourable Chair, is SADC FR, an important building block in the development of South Africa's North-South foreign policy objectives. Dealing with a big organ like the EU, with its 28 member states, it's important that we try and maximize our gains in terms of our negotiations. In line with NDP objectives, the SADC FR will advance the region and national industrialization for promotion of exports. Importantly, it will also provide a basis of value addition and beneficiation within the region. These two elements are important in any promotion of our foreign policy and economic diplomacy. The terms of economic partnership agreement that SADC EFTA countries have negotiated with the European Union are an improvement on South Africa's bilateral agreement with the EU. Furthermore, negotiating an agreement in the SADC region was a foreign policy achievement. I thank you.
Are you done, Advocate?
No.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let me just explain. I have to take some 2 or 3 minutes outside for an urgent matter regarding the committee work that I have to give you. That it's not out of this context for this pardon me for that. Now I'm going to invite comments or questions from the members regarding the 2 presentations, particularly the presentation from the GPI. Honorable Khalapa, you want to first? Let's move to Honorable Khalapa. That one. So, my email.
Thank you very much, Chair, and let me welcome you to the occasion. I just got a question on the issue of regional integration. Why do you call it a SADC EFR as opposed to a SADC? Because if we say the SADC EFR, then we mean all the 15 SADC member countries. But apparently it's just only the 7 of which the 6 are in the SAPU agreement. So it may be a SAPU EFR. I don't see why we call it a SADC EFR if it doesn't incorporate all 50 member countries. So shouldn't we say call it a SAPU as opposed to SAPU? The second one is the effect on the tripartite agreement. Alliance, no, not the alliance here, but the agreement, the trade agreement of SADC in East Africa and CONESA East Africa and Community of East Africa. So, what would be the impact there? And why the rest of the so-called SADC countries decide to go to East Africa? And what is the status of that? As far as the EFAC is concerned, because of half the 7 the EFAC and the other has chosen the East Africa. And you're talking regional integration. So I think that what we want to achieve with what is happening practically. There are two very distinct parallel processes. When you talk integration and industrialization, in fact, as you know, we've got the SADC indicated strategic plan, and I see it not happening because of seven have signed the Southern SADC earmark, seven have signed the East Africa earmark. So I don't understand how that is right. And what is the status of the East Africa earmark? Have they already signed and ratified? And last thing, Chair, is on the Soto, because of they are the only ones that left to ratify the South part of the earmark. By when do we anticipate, without interfering on their territorial integrity and their so-called sovereignty, when do we expect that? Because they are the only country in the South part of the earmark that has not yet ratified. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Jay. Just to follow on what my colleague was saying, in terms of EFAS and EFAS, I was interested to find out a country like Angola, what actually preventing them from coming into the agreement? What are their concerns? You know, this presentation looks like the Glamail advert. It means all too good to be true. It's all the good stuff, I just want to know, does anything that they picked up from DCR or from Durka that might give a negative, there might be a negative thing that you should be looking out for? Because I want to know also in terms of exclusivity, whether there is any agreements on it in terms of preferential rates. Is there any cause there that might lead to exclusivity or the impression or perception of exclusivity that we, you know, if we have another trade agreement in terms of what we refer to as the most favored nations, in the sense, what happens there? Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation from both departments, ECO and DCI, because when you listen to the presentation of ECO, it's similar to what I was saying in GK. So I think I'll treat them with the same treatment. But to me, Peter, when we enter into this agreement in South Africa, it was very clear from the beginning when you signed the chapter, the PDA, that you are entering this agreement at a weak position. Taking for your agreement. I mean, taking from your presentation that you have presented here. And also, just to get a clarity, if you enter into agreement, especially this one with the EU, because one of the disadvantages when you enter into agreement with the EU is that it's very difficult to get out of it. So, do you have a time frame? Because at some point when you go to negotiations, at some point maybe you don't have all your facts, you just discover it in the meeting, which is this is tough. So you just enter into agreement with no time frame, or you have a clear time frame. So, after this so much, I will just pull out. How does it work? Secondly, I don't know, it pains me, Chair, when you listen to some of the terms, especially when you talk about 86% of EU over 12 years. I think it was too much. Exactly what you confirmed that at some point when it comes to agricultural sector, there was some pressure at some point whereby the EU seems as a beneficiary over us. South Africa. And then the other question that I'll pose under geographical indication, as you mentioned that we have always to enter into negotiations because you told us about those 120 wines, 5 beers and so on and so on. Is it working? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks, let me start by appreciating the presentations.
Something is mentioned here of exporting more focus to the EU. Now, it baffles me sometimes. Who's more focus on it? Because where I am now, I believe we don't have a South African brand of a motor car. And I've been living this question, not knowing who to pose this question to, but I'm ready to say, come to my assistance. When do we think we can be able to produce our own? Are there maybe two people that are us from doing that? Another thing that I need clarity on, the standstill clause. How does it operate? Does it operate from both sides? Or we are the only ones who are supposed to stand still while others are moving? And there's the issue of Botswana, is it Botswana's three policies? As things then now, do you think they will be able to beat that deadline? And what are the implications if maybe they are unable to? There is also last year this thing on the full implementation, I think it was the CDCA, where it took South Africa 2 years more to implement than the EU. What could be the reasons, and how do we fare in other trade negotiations? Are we found to be lagging behind most of the time, and what could be the reason there? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for the two presentations. My first question would be on page 3, the bullet for that was to the international integration. What will be the intent on the agenda question as a total agenda study towards a specific area in the continent? In the continent. And my second question is on page 5, that talks to you believe on your main startup main trading partner. Now I have confusion with you. I don't understand the issues. First bullet talks to you, it means the South Africa's main trading partner. What happens? What is happening in China, which is also regarded as the largest trading partner? Now, I'm confused when you are talking about the EU and the main trading partner, South Africa. Now, and why I want you to something to be seen to me about that, because to me that is and Asia also is the largest trading region. So that makes the confusion to me, oh, the largest. This is the reality that it's also, yes, I understand for open market facilities, but now my question is on the issue of this partnership, of this partnership in the trade. Also, what are the issues that in self-determination of the European Union in South Africa? What was done to address the issue of the elimination of exports? I think the last bullet, elimination of export taxes. How does that address this issue of elimination for the latter in the Guardian, the update of the inclusion in the sovereign state of the decision-making of the speech.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to both the presenters for your presentation. Just keep in mind that it's a good presentation, and I know that you're pitching it at the MP, but you know, it's a lot of talk, and the language sometimes is very, it comes up some of the things. Now, my first question is, these trade deals that are negotiated, what is the impact on small business? South Africa talks about pro-poor policies. Now, tell me how these agreements stand on that. The impact of the clothing sector industry seems to be glossed over. Why do you refer to a 237% increase in trade? What has the actual impact been on the clothing sector? Do you refer to a single stage transformation rule on textiles and clothing? Can you unpack that? What does that mean? Honourable Kenya referred to EU as the South Africa's main trading partner, and in the presentation you also referred to UK being the 8th largest trading partner of South Africa in 2015. Who are the other three? The protocol was debated in Parliament last Tuesday. And the question is, now, once the protocol is ratified, it comes into force. I don't know if the required number of countries, how many countries were required to ratify before it comes into force? And then coming into force now, before the Brexit exit, what will the impact be? Because remember, we're doing it under a different phase now. So, you know, what would the UK exiting? What is that impact? You refer to export taxes on page 11, madam, under certain circumstances. Again, the vagueness of the language. What do you actually mean? You must remember, we've got to go back and talk to our people about it. If I'm in certain circumstances, if you ask me what does that mean, so you must tell me what that means. And then lastly, this is a tongue-in-cheek comment, but nonetheless, I will make it. South Africa has got a new market access for 150 tons of duty-free sugar. Okay, that's wonderful. South Africa has also now put in a law on sugar tax. So companies that would be using the sugar, like Coca-Cola, may exit the country because it might be detrimental to their business. As I said, the tongue-in-cheek comment. Do we brag about this, or will this sort of fact have an impact on it? I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I want to add my voice in thanking the contributors to this beautiful and well-trusted life. I just want to find out something that might be confusing. I want to make an example about German cars. Am I correct in saying that it produced iron ore exported to Germany, comes back in the form of cars that are then assembled in South Africa and then exported as cars to Europe? Is that the position? If it is, then how do you adjust your percentages to give us exactly what is our safe balance regarding this? Do we make gain when we export the war? And we make a loss when they come as part and we import it, and then we export it. What? How do you balance what is the other position? That's all. Thank you.
Honorable Adley.
Thank you. Yeah, it just seems to take forever to get our heads around this EPA thing. Obviously, traditionally, South Africa seems to have been really negative towards EPAs for particular reasons. I hope, does this mean that those things we were particularly negative about have all changed and it's now the right thing to do? Or is it just that there's a little window that we're trying to compromise? I'm looking now specifically at where it says EPA rules of origin would now allow for extended accumulation that can facilitate inter-regional trade. So there's some key words there like inter-regional trade and industrialization that make you think that's a good statement. But I'm still really, if I ask myself, do I really get what the EPA is, how much they've changed now to make this possible, and what does that mean to ordinary people? How can we say that in a way that it's going to mean something to anybody in terms of these EPAs now from being the bogeyman to becoming something that we want to get behind? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine is on actually, let me first actually congratulate for such a wonderful and a good presentation. My question firstly would be on slide 4 and also bullet number 4 relating to tariff schedule, where he said that South Africa committed to grant duty-free access to 86% over a period of 12 years, and the EU liberalized 95% of South Africa's imports over a period of 10 years. Now there is obviously a two-year discrepancy there. So how do you deal with that? Because it means that that we will still be committed to duty-free whilst the other partners will no longer be actually committed to anything. So how do we ameliorate for those 2 years? That's one. Number two is, I would actually like to get some more information on this uneven market access in agriculture, because then there are, in my view, there is an access imbalance here, and this is a very critically important sector of our economy, because it employs a lot of people. So if there are those imbalances, how does it then help us in addressing issues of unemployment? Again, on your slide number 6, you are saying that South Africa exports have been highly concentrated on primary products. Are you saying that we are actually exporting a lot of raw material, and in a sense therefore lose on beneficiation and actually on issues of job creation? And how can we actually turn this around, because we remain committed to addressing the issue of unemployment and things like those, so that if we continue to be exporting unprocessed products, then we are losing on job creation. Another issue is that there are people who are actually not quite happy with the ethos, saying that, arguing that they threaten to kill off African prospects for growth. Is this true? If so, why are we still there? If not, can you give us some details on that? And the last one actually has to do with the deadlock, the dispute resolution mechanism, because in any agreements, the trade agreements in, for that matter, you would actually have disputes here and there, and how do you actually deal with those disputes? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I also have the privilege to make one or two comments? Thank you very much for your presentation. On the presentation that was made by On slide four. The first point, there's something that I don't understand very well on slide four, where you are talking about the tariff schedule. You say that South Africa committed to grant duty-free access to 86% of Western imports over 20 years. Then it was fully implemented while the EU liberalized 97% of South Africa's imports. If I can just get an explanation of that. There is something that you say has happened here. You say that the TDCA reshaped South Africa's policies based in a number of areas. I'm just wondering, because we're talking about trade among and different countries here, and you're talking about policy space. I thought you were talking about trade space or something like that, or trade relations or whatever. Then, together with that, then you say there is an uneven market access in agriculture, which actually makes me ask the question that I've asked earlier on about clarification on liberalization. Because to the extent that I know, the European markets in a number of areas, a lot of members have indicated, is very protectionist, particularly on agricultural products, not allowing other countries to move in, while they call upon African countries to liberalize. And that is what has allowed the trade deficit between us and them for many years. On slide 9, what is this MFN? One of the bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, it says subject to a preference margin if the MFN rate is raised. Members don't know what it is. On the presentation made by Advocate Kassinje, on slide 5, maybe let me just go back a bit. Yeah, on slide 5, you see that, where you are saying that we receive protection for 105 geographical indicators names. Then you're talking about wine names and three agricultural products, rooibos, honeybush, and carola. Are you saying that these products go into the European market or anywhere else in the world? In their South African names, is that what you are saying here? And what has happened, or what is happening to the South African wines? Because I know that France and our best wine makers here are among the people who came, what is that from France, you know, the French Bocuse. In France, you will find good wines there. Now, France has been leading the I don't know what word to use, but you know, has been leading the team, not that, but something that does not want South African wines to penetrate too much into both France as a country and Europe, because this would undermine their own products. So what has happened of age? Can go into these countries and find that these are South African wines written in Dutch or in Afghans mainly, you know, and made in South Africa. But there was this other type of perish at a time, who got tired of the European shoot, who wanted African cuisine, and we didn't find it. But we did find very good wine there, and we danced it the night away. Don't ask how I'm doing. Then on the agreement itself between the PPA states between SADC and the European Union, Article 114 says this agreement shall be valid indefinitely. Actually, there are three things that are written there. I start by saying this agreement shall be valid indefinitely. Then it goes on then that if one of the parties would like to denounce this, then it must give 6 months notice, da 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 da. But what kind of an agreement is valid indefinitely? Because what it does, it means a particular government in another country and other countries are binding many other governments for the future. And things may change ideologically and politically, you know. We've got different parties in different countries. Is it not going to have an impact? I know that trade agreements must be long range in their own nature. But it says indefinitely, it doesn't say subject to negotiations from time to time. I don't see how it famous. In the WTO, how are we organized as either the African continent or as SADC or as South Africa? Because I'm told it's a dog eat dog situation there. Each one must just negotiate how to price base for their products, because it's money for the country, it's income for the country. So, in my speech earlier this year, when we were debating the budget of this budget, I actually said that we need a pan-African negotiating team, either the whole Africa or regions, just to say we as Africa, or we as Conesa, or as Sade, this is the price, this is what we are going to sell for our gold, or for our oil, something like common price. But the way I see it, and I'm speaking as a lay person, the way I see it, they approach us as the European Union. Even when they come here to meet with me, and sometimes they come and meet our own farms, and sometimes she invites me. They meet us as a group with a group leader. For instance, Ambassador Khan or Lechner. Now, but they meet us as individuals. From here they go to Swaziland. They meet us as individual countries, but they meet us as a group. Now, if they do this, they always have an advantage of knowing who thinks what and who can be outmaneuvered, outclassed, and outwitted where, in this area of where. And you see, if I say this politically, I would say that since the Berlin Conference of 1894, Africa was supposed to be a colony that was struggling with raw material, and to this day it is still happening. That's on one part. But the other part is not for you, it's political. It is that there is a weakness on our part in the leadership of the African continent, talking to the president and prime minister and heads of state. Because we talk about industrialization for SADC, industrialization for Africa. We have raw material, we've got diamonds, we've got water in the DRC, we've got oil, and we're just not industrializing. We are exporting raw material to this day. Some countries, 50 years after independence, we are 22 years, some are 40 years. I think it's more a matter for the political leadership of the country. Because we can't say industrialization and not it. The last one was, I've already said something about protectionism and liberalization, right? Yeah. almost in both presentations, we continue to say this agreement or the trade relations continues to show a trade deficit against South Africa or against SADC or against Africa. I don't know what is being done in this area of work to offset this. So that at least when it comes to certain items, we should sell more to the European, to the Europeans or to the European market. It's very lucrative. They are rich. There's a lot of money we can find for a country. Can we hear you? I'm not sure if you will be able to respond to a person, but where there is a consequence of questions or comments, just give them to get an answer. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. With regards to the first question as to why are we talking about SADC EPA group when it is only including SACU member states plus two. As I indicated in my presentation, Honorable Members, the considerations for the negotiation of the EPA were EU considerations. And there was a lot of discussion in the continent about the implications of these EU considerations because they're not aligned to the regional economic communities of the continent. So it is not SADC, that's why there's a distinction that it is not the SADC EPA, but it is the SADC EPA group. Because it's a grouping of SADC countries that are negotiating the EPA. So that is the distinction. I know that sometimes it does create a confusion, but that is what it means, that it's not the full membership of SADC, it is the SADC EPA group. In terms of how SADC countries are participating in the EPA considerations, I indicated, Honorable Members, that SADC countries are participating under three different considerations. You've got the SADC EPA group, which consists of the seven. Angola participated actively in the negotiations, but decided not to sign. I will also deal with why Angola has not signed. Angola is not participating in any trade agreement, even in the continent. They are part of SADC, but have not acceded to the SADC trade protocol. So Angola has taken a decision as a country that it is in the process, because it is still involved in the process of building its country, it is reviewing how it will participate in trade negotiations. So it's nothing related to the outcome of the EPA specifically, it's because they are still rebuilding their own country. The status of the EAC and whether they have signed, maybe I should clarify the three configurations. The seven includes the SACU member states, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, Swaziland and South Africa, Mozambique, with Angola indicating that it is signed at a later stage, but it's not that they fully participated. That's the SADC EPA group. Then we have the EAC group, which includes all the EAC member states. It's Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, that are part of the EAC. Then you have the other countries that are not part of the EAC and not part of the SADC EPA group, that are SADC members, that were shaken under the East and Southern Africa, the EPA group. So your Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi, Mauritius, all of them are participating under the EFSA. As I've indicated, Honorable Members, we were also one of those countries that have had concerns around the implications of these different configurations in how we are advancing our regional integration agenda. Unfortunately, we could not resolve that issue, so we continue to participate in the same configuration. But what was critical is the discussion that we've been having and continue to have at the African Union level, that we should, as different regions, share the outcomes of the negotiation. So whenever trade ministers meet, there is sharing of information about what are the issues that I mentioned in this group, but also sharing of the text that are negotiated. And the aim for that is to ensure that there is alignment in the different texts that are negotiated by the different groupings to limit the negative impact the different positions may have on regional integration. But also, we have looked at the legal provisions, especially those that are critical to how we are going to advance the regional integration agenda. The continent, we have agreed to advance the development integration agenda, which combines three pillars. The market integration pillar, which is about negotiating trade agreements amongst ourselves. The second pillar being infrastructure development. The third pillar being industrial development through the development of regional value chain. Because all of these, especially the two pillars, infrastructure and industrial development, those are the critical pillars to enable us to increase intra-Africa trade. Because the key constraints to Africa trade are not necessarily tariffs. Tariffs contribute a small part to why we are not trading with each other. And because if you look at the level of trade of tariffs, we have been able to reduce tariffs due to the commitments that we have made individually in the WTO and customs territory. So the tariffs are not the major constraints to intra-Africa trade. The key constraints to the low levels of intra-Africa trade are the fact that we do not have productive capacity or we have similar productive structures that limit the potential to trade, or it is also the issue related to interconnectivity between countries. So the development integration agenda therefore aims to deal with all the issues that are constraints in a more integrated and comprehensive manner so that we are able to integrate the continent. So the TFTA is therefore a strategic agreement that we are implementing, including the Continental FTA that was launched in June 2015 in South Africa. The aim of the TFTA, the COMESA EAC started at Free Trade Area, as well as the Continental FTA, are a response to ensure that we are able, because other regions are also busy with their own mechanisms. This would be Africa's way of responding to those mega-regionals and to ensure that we have a market that provides better preferential access than we are enjoying as African countries outside of the country. So that is the aim of the JT and the contribution.
Yes, I'm just trying to think of that. Just for the sake of us to understand, the TFTA is the one that needs more time to grow.
Okay. So the TFTA is not indicated on a lot of members, it's the free trade area between EAC, the common market for East and Southern Africa, the EAC is the East African Community, and SADC, which is the Southern Africa Development Community. So it's called the tripartite because it is linking up those three regional economic communities. The Continental Free Trade Area is a free trade area that is launched, that was launched in June 2015 in Johannesburg, South Africa, and it will be a free trade agreement between the 54 member states of the African Union. So it is the African Continent Free Trade Agreement that will include all the members of the African Union. So those are the arrangements, which is why I was saying, honorable members, that is our response to ensure that we are able to still embark in our own process of enhancing regional economic integration. The other question was the status of the EAC, whether they have signed the EPA. Two members of the EAC have signed, Kenya and Rwanda signed, I think it was last week, the Economic Partnership Agreement. The other countries of the EAC are yet to sign. by when will Lesotho ratify? It's a difficult question to respond to, Honourable Member, because it's based on the internal processes of the country. But all the SACCO countries have committed to ratify before the deadline, which is 1 October 2016. So we believe that Lesotho will be able to meet the deadline. They have not communicated otherwise. I have responded to Angola and why Angola has not signed the Economic Partnership Agreement. In terms of the question on exclusivity, and I think this will capture some of the comments that were raised about the implications of the EPA and whether we have been able to resolve all the issues and what does the EPA mean. I think any trade agreement has costs and benefits for any country that is participating. Because the trade agreement is about elimination or reduction of tariffs, which provides protection to domestic industry. What determines whether this is beneficial or not is whether the benefits outweigh the costs. Otherwise, there will always be costs and there will always be winners and losers in a trade agreement by its nature. And the trade agreement, because we already have negotiated under the WTO, we negotiate and have legally binding international commitments in terms of the level of tariffs at the most favored nation level, which means the tariff that we charge to any product that is coming from the rest of the world other than from those countries we have a trade agreement with. So because already we have the MFN, and in the case of the EPA, we are, as I indicated, Honourable Members, we are not starting from scratch. We are starting from the TDCA. So the floor is the TDCA. So whether the EPA is beneficial or not, we have to look at it as whether we have managed to get additional market access beyond what we had in the TDCA, whether we have been able to get better policy space in terms of the policy tools that we can use to advance our agenda. And if we look at that, we then say the EPA is beneficial because we now have additional market access beyond what we had. And in terms of the cost and benefits, our view and our assessment is that the benefits outweigh the cost because of where we are starting from. Any trade agreement will have a level of exclusivity because you are saying, as a country, you are granting a preference to a specific partner that you are negotiating with outside of the agreement that you have with the rest of the world. So the EPA, therefore, needs preferential market access for SACCO to the EU market and vice versa. So there is a level of exclusivity. In terms of the time frame, by their nature, trade agreements are, I would say, under inverted commas, permanent. Because the aim for that is that a trade agreement must assist to provide a predictable trade arrangement or environment, but also must assist us to attract investment. Because investors, when they come to a country, they look at the markets that they have access to for their products. So a trade agreement assists us to say any investor, whether domestic or foreign, that establishes a plant in South Africa will have preferential market access in SACCO, in ZADAC, in the tripartite, in the continent, once we have concluded the CFTA, and then in Mercosur, in the EU, through the EPA. So those are, that becomes the value proposition that we put as a country to investors to say, come and invest in South Africa. So I've responded to the issue of the time frame, and I think it came from a number of honourable members. But I must indicate, honourable chair, that there is a review clause. Even though it is a more, under inverted commas, permanent arrangement, there is a review clause. And the institutions that are established under the EPA identifications that we are going to lose as a country if there is a need for to engage the EU on any matter that we feel should be put under review. But to the extent possible, the aim is to ensure that we have a predictable business environment. The 86%, I think it was raised by a number of honourable members, so what do we mean by this 86%, and does it mean we are lagging behind because there are lives at a slower rate than the EU? As I indicated in the presentation, honourable members, the aim, why we agreed to this arrangement in this way, it was to take into account that the EU is a developed region. South Africa is a developing country. So if a developing country has to say to the EU, the level playing field is not the same, and the Honourable has also referred to the level of protection in the EU in terms of subsidies that we do not have in South Africa. So all of those issues had to come into account. And we then had to say, we can't liberalise as if we are starting from the same level playing field. Since the level playing field is different, we will liberalize less as a developing country vis-à-vis the EU, and will take longer to implement vis-à-vis the EU. So they liberalize faster in Kenya, and the coverage is 95% when it comes to them. When it comes to South Africa, it's 86%, and we liberalize at a slower pace, which means over a period of 12 years. The asymmetry was built into that agreement because we have different levels of development. And it was a conscious decision by South Africa to say it must be like that so that we can provide some cushion and opportunity for adjustment to some of our industries as we implement the ETA. I must also indicate, honourable members, that for any FTA, the mutual definition is that it must cover substantially all trades, which means that
In conclusion,
I think Honourable Chair, what we can then say is that in our view, the EPA, because they are cost and benefits, they are costs and will be some implications for some of the industries, but what we aim to ensure is that it assists us to change the structure of our trade to more focusing on export on the value-added product. We have seen a change in that. We are able to export now due to the TPCA, and it will also continue under the EPA. We are exporting machinery, we are exporting chemical products, we are exporting vehicles, and there was a question as to whose vehicles are we exporting. I think what is important to us is that we are a country that is saying we are open to investment. And because of also some of the principles within the WTO, the National Treatment Provision, what we are saying is that any investor that is based in South Africa does contribute to job creation, that does contribute to industrial development of the country, and it does contribute to us changing the export basket of our products. So at the end of the day, even though the companies or the OEMs are not necessarily owned by South Africa, they are making a good contribution in South Africa. So, but there is, through the ATGP, a process to ensure that we are able to develop our own auto sector, and the Industrial Development Division of the DGI is responsible for that. Maybe I should conclude then, Honourable Chair. Thank you. There was a question on the geographic indications, Chair.
Okay.
On the GIs, the benefit...
What are GIs?
Geographic indications. It's the protection of names. As I indicated, Honourable Chair, the names are protected because they have specific characteristics, and those characteristics are because the product is coming from a specific locality. So if a wine, for example, that is coming in friendship, and has a specific taste which differentiates from any other wine that is coming from elsewhere, it will qualify for a GI protection. And that name is going to be protected in the EU. So that chapter allows us to then protect those names, but also there is a commercial value in the protection of the name, because a name that is attached to a GI, it means that it attracts a higher value in the market. So there are benefits for South Africa. So it's a reciprocal arrangement. We are protecting South African names in the EU, and we are protecting EU names in South Africa. But most importantly, Chair, we are also allowing for coexistence for those products that were produced prior to the entry into force of the Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We can allow her to answer the questions, but then I want to speak to something else. There's a group that's going to come here for item number 6. And preceding that, I'm going to engage ourselves. I'll tell you what the engagement is among ourselves. And then, I have a meeting with of chairpersons of committees with another colleague at 11:45 or 12:45.
12:45.
Yeah, so we still have good time. Now, and we can then open some space for the two or three questions that are still there.
What time is the group
coming? 11:30. So we can't. Okay. Okay, so the questions before we'll...
If we understand the it is totally the same, put us beyond another context. So we appreciate what the reason is doing that, but it is our thing, so that we can be able to flow with the criteria. I'm sorry, obviously we said, but obviously don't, so that when she answers, we must answer this on what actually is
what we are doing. You just spoke to that much earlier, man. Honorable Mamo, Umlobi Peter, Shabonga, who is presentation here, you can remain with us and advocate questions there. Now on item number...
Should we just ask for their questions to have a written response?
Yes, because of the press of time, I said it's no longer possible now. How are we going to handle this?
Any
questions?
No, she's got the questions already.
So we're not going to stay.
Individual members, the department will be requested to submit written answers to the questions that the members will
Those questions. Oh, okay. So I wanted to say the briefing that we're going to get now. What I was saying is this group or delegation calls itself the South African Jews for a Free Palestine. And what they did some 4 or 5 weeks ago, they spoke to the deputy speaker requesting audience with the Parliament of South Africa. Now,
in their communique, they indicated that they would meet, they want to meet the Committee on International Relations. But for your own ease, I'm going to refer to the structures that they are saying that they are going to meet.
Can you give us his book?
Now, in their letter they say that it is proposed, I'm reading it verbatim, it is proposed that a delegation of five activists from Palestine, two members of ADRIS, all districts from Libya, one representative from Zohrot, and a representative from Adala and Fadil are brought out to South Africa for a 2 week long speaking talk. During this period, meetings will be held for the general public, for Palestinian solidarity movement organizations, for the Jewish community including the JNF, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, and the South African Zionist Federation, and the Zionist Youth Movement. Special meetings will also be convened with the South African government, South African political parties, and a parliamentary portfolio committee on international relations. Now, the deputy speaker then said that must make arrangements and meet with the
now the reason why I'm speaking to you is because after it appeared in our agenda that
the South African Jewish Board of Deputies then wrote a letter to me to say we have noted that there is this item. We think we also want to come and address the committee so that we can give the other side of the story. Now, the other letter then came from Honorable Mwango, who is here with us, that he has been persuaded by the ambassador of, or requested by the ambassador of Israel to South Africa, that it is this delegation that is going to talk to us, and it is a pro-Palestinian lobby group, and he is requesting that if we allow them to address us, the ambassador must be here. The other person who has been persuaded or requested is Honorable Dudley. Honorable Dudley sent an SMS to the committee secretary to say, can we also have Ambassador Lenk to come here to give us the other view regarding matters around Palestine. Now, I have responded to Honorable Mwango, and I want to thank you for the letter, Honorable Mwango. And I have not in writing, because it was an SMS, I went to the bench of Honorable Dali and I had discussions with her. And the response was that as a South African parliament, or on behalf of the South African parliament, and as a country, we are free, and they must be free to be addressed and to receive different political parties or church or unions or individuals who don't necessarily agree with each other, either in their own country or in this country. But they must be able to address us as parliament. Secondly, I just said both to Honorable Norman and Honorable Tati that they, as committee members, first and foremost, represent the interest of the committee and, by extension, the interest of the parliament of the Republic of South Africa, first and foremost. Now, ambassadors don't have to address the committee via a request to them. I said, no, just advise the ambassador to write a letter directly to me or to the committee staff to request for an audience with us, and we are going to continue on the same subject, for instance. It doesn't have to be anything else. If it seems, for instance, there's some damage being made or some wrong thing being told to us,
It will be good that Arasabalek actually comes here, and because you know you were asked by such people, and this is what they said, in fact the right thing is 1, 2, 3. You see. So, I've written to Mwango and I've said the same thing to Udasi. No, I don't have the letter from Ambassador Lang. And it would be inappropriate, procedurally speaking, that when a certain group comes here and then we then invite you. Just like that, invite you just like that. And there is no letter requesting in it. But if we get that letter, he certainly will come and address us. And thirdly, it was that now there are many other things I want to speak to just generally about the policy perspective before we have this group. One is that many of the members will remember that in our international relations policy perspective we have said we want a humane and a caring world order, equitable world order, in which negotiations are free between among parties. Many of you will remember what was said even during the time of the negotiations, that Jojo is better than Omo. And the South African diplomacy that we pursue is a diplomacy of Ubuntu, in terms of which, particularly in the African continent,
I'll give you a point of ownership. I think in your opening statement you've circled the matter, in my view. And I don't think that there is any need to go into detailed policy perspective. We are a parliament representing the people. We are entitled to hear any side and everyone. Would you really make an official request to the parliament to come and see us? I think that is the bottom line. We are duty bound to do that. If there is a request from either side and you've got a letter to get, schedule a separate meeting for now. But I think now we will be wasting time because we've got a delegation that's outside that wants to do that too. Our duty is to listen to either side, however comfortable it might be, without putting our policy positions across. But we have settled the matter quite efficiently. And I would propose that we proceed and allow people to come and present their stories to us, and we will ask questions later. Then I propose. Thanks for your intervention, and that they will respond to you. So much.
Yeah, second.
I remember the second day is better, it's fourth day. Oh, thank you very much. Okay, then allow the delegation to move here. Thank you, Khalaf. So they don't have a son. Khalaf has been coming down on me and some man. I have a bit of a spread of time. Most welcome with your delegation.
to the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and to the precincts of the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. We received your request through the Office of the Deputy Speaker that there are different stakeholders or parties that you wanted to address, and that we are one such stakeholder. As a Portfolio Committee of the Republic of South Africa, we receive delegations from different countries, from the DRC, from Burundi, sometimes Lesotho, represent as appointed envoys in other countries. So we receive quite, sometimes it's government, etc. I just want to introduce some of the members of Parliament here who belong to this committee, and then I will then refer to you to introduce yourself and your delegation, and then thereafter I assume that you are the one who is going to speak on behalf of the delegation. So from outside we have officials here and the members of Parliament, but we will introduce the members of Parliament. Right in the beginning there, you have Honorable Mnwango. He's a member of this committee, the member of Parliament, Honorable Mnwango. The lady there, the tall lady, she's seated for now, is Honorable Dudley. Yeah, in South Africa, when you respect a person, you don't call them, you call the Senate. Okay. Yeah, then the next one is Honorable Kofi, member of Parliament, member of this committee. The next one is Honorable Maila, member of Parliament, member of this committee. And the next one, the lady here, is Honorable Kenye, member of Parliament, member of this committee. The next one is Honorable Raputi. And the next one on my left side, the lady here is Honorable Kalyan. And then the next one is the gentleman is Honorable Mukhalapa, member of Parliament, member of this committee. The next one is Honorable Dahma, member of this, this committee. And my name is Siposezwe Sango. I'm currently the chairperson or chairman, depending on which country you come from, chairman of this portfolio committee. And with that, I want to defer to you to introduce yourself in the delegation.
Thank you, Honorable. Good evening, thank you, Honorable Mashango, and honorable members of this committee. Just as a matter of procedure, before I proceed, we have requested members of the delegation to make short inputs, particularly in one colleague in his mother tongue, if that's possible, particularly because they bring testimony. I would like to introduce the delegation and give you some background as to who we are, South African Jews for the Palestine. We deeply appreciate that honor and privilege to address this esteemed committee today.
Sorry for interjecting. The one who is going to speak in his or her mother tongue, will there be somebody translating into English?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, okay.
Yes, indeed. So on behalf of South African Youth for Free Palestine, I'd like to thank you for allowing me, along with my colleague Mo Davis and Emma Gates, to appear before you with our Palestinian guests from Israel, from inside Israel, Naif Hajo, Omar Al-Khubari, Musa Tahir, and Nisana Morani. Allow me to tell you something very briefly about South African Jews for Free Palestine. We're one of various groups representing a growing number of South African Jews who have taken the view that Jewish ethical traditions of Tikkun Olam, or repair of the world, of justice and responsibility towards our fellow human beings, must guide us to understand and respond to experiences that have been excluded from our self-understanding as South African Jews. This includes acknowledging that there's more than one narrative of Jewish history, and there's more than one narrative of a Jewish past that the official one, the State of Israel, has promoted, as ethnicity, religion, and national identity is used to justify oppression. We believe we are obliged to speak against the unconditional defense, of a state that acts in our name. In 2015, a diverse group of Jewish South Africans traveled with more than 200 signed pledges to Israel. We went to participate in a ceremony at the destroyed Palestinian village called Loga. It's one of between 530 and just over 600 such destroyed villages. The inhabitants of Loga were expelled in 1948, and the village was destroyed to prevent them from returning. Loga's remains are scattered beneath the Jewish National Park forest called South Africa Forest. It is planted in the name of our country and in the name of all South Africans. Many of us in the Jewish group who traveled to the ceremony contributed our pocket money as children to the JMFU boxes, believing that we were greening the land and that we were greening the desert in a land that we were told was unpopulated, empty, uncultivated. On learning that this narrative had hidden the existence of Loga and the people who had lived there until 1948, many of us felt deceived that actions, that such actions had been undertaken and continued in our name. Over the past years, we have committed ourselves to meet, to engage with the very people whose presence has been erased from the landscape and history that we were taught. So the ceremony was hosted by the Association for the Defense and Rights of Internally Displaced Palestinians, ADIS, by Zohorot, the NGO, we'll hear more from our guests, and participants also included Jewish Israelis. We handed over more than 200 pledges, in which we acknowledged that we planted trees in South Africa forest and contributed further to the pain of Palestinians who had been expelled from their villages, whose experiences were denied. So we committed ourselves to build relationships with people and civil society organizations and to develop new ways of addressing these experiences in order to imagine a shared future. Following on from our initiatives in Israel in 2015, we invited our colleagues from Madrid and from Zohorot and from Adala, a legal organization also inside Israel, to visit us in South Africa to hold meetings and attend public events. As Palestinian citizens of Israel, our guests here today bring insight to an often untold story of the Palestinian situation, the story of Palestinians who live inside Israel, and in this way to help us to contribute positively to change. So I would like to invite our guests from Israel, who we invited as part of our delegation, to offer a short presentation to the committee, with your permission, Honourable Chair.
Yes. Good morning.
اسمي نايف حجو. انا رئيس جمعية الدفاع عن حقوق المهاجرين في اسرائيل. هذه الجمعية التي تأسست بعد حادثات اوسلو ومدريد بين وفد حكومة اسرائيل ووفد منظمة التحرير الفلسطينية، واتفق بأن قضية المهجرين في الداخل هي قضية إسرائيلية، كون المهجرين مواطني الكيان الإسرائيلي.
Hi, good morning everybody. My name is Naif Hazou. I'm just translating for Transkei, gentlemen. I'm the head of the association called ADRID, the Association for Defense for the Rights of the Internally Displaced Palestinians inside the State of Israel. Our association was established in 1992, immediately after Oslo Agreement, because the result of this agreement was to keep the case of the internal displaced Palestinians inside the state of Israel as an internal issue for the state, for Israel, and not part of the whole Palestinian refugees issue.
الجمعية تقوم بالنضال من أجل إعادة مهجري 600 قرية فلسطينية دمرت وهجر منها أكثر من 750 ألف مهجر من قبل الجيش الإسرائيلي في حرب 1948.
The main purpose of our association is to struggle in order to implement the return of the more than 750,000 Palestinians have been expelled in 1948 from about 600 Palestinian localities, villages and towns at 1948. The main struggle is to raise the case of return and demand to implement it.
لقد ولدت في إحدى هذه القرى المدمرة التي دمرها الاحتلال واسمها قرية لوبيا قضاء طرية.
I was born in one of those villages. The name of my village is Lubia in Tiberias district.
لقد انتقلت مع عائلتي الصغيرة بعد أن هجر 4,000 مواطن من قريتي إلى خارج البلاد. انتقلت مع عائلتي الصغيرة إلى قرية ديرحنا القريبة من لوبيا.
All 4,000 residents of Lubia forced to leave their village. My small family found itself in the end of the day in a nearby village in the Galilee called Deir Hanna, but most of my village residents have been moved and forced to immigrate outside the borders of the state of Israel.
في بادئ وصولنا إلى قرية دير حنا بسبب تواجد عدد كبير من اللاجئين والمهجرين في محيط القرية. فكنا في الكروم في كروم الزيتون تحت الأشجار.
In the first days and weeks when we forced to move nearby the village of Deir Hanna, we didn't find a place or house to live in, so we stayed among the trees and the mountains around the village.
وبعد فرار موسم الشتاء وابتداء المطر قامت مجموعة من أقارب لنا في القرية بدعوتنا إلى داخل القرية للسكن معهم في بيوتهم.
Only when the winter started that year, some of our relatives in the village of Deir Hanna looked for us and invited us to stay in their house in the village. The original village was expelled on the summer, on July. But we found the first house to live in only in the beginning of the winter.
لقد ربح المواطنون العرب من سنة 1948 حتى سنة 1960 تحت الحكم العسكري الإسرائيلي.
We as the other Palestinians inside the state of Israel who became citizens of the state of Israel lived under military regime since 1948 till 1966.
لم يسمح للمهجرين العودة إلى قراهم ولا حتى زيارتها إلا بعد أكثر من 20 عاما.
We were not allowed to see our original village or visit the village and we did that for the first time after about 20 years.
وعندما زرت قريتي المدمرة المذكورة لأول مرة وجدتها مغطاة بغابة كبيرة.
When I visited my village for the first time after about 20 years, I found my village covered by trees and a forest.
وعندها كنت برفقة والدي وأخذوني إلى موقع البيت الذي ولدت فيه ووجدته مدمرا كوما من الحجارة حيث دمر بعد الاحتلال. وتبين أن هذا البيت مدمر والمدرسة مدمرة والمسجد مدمر ومجلس العائلة الكبيرة مدمر والشوارع مملوءة مغطاة بالحجارة من خلال هدم البيوت بيوت القرية كاملة.
At that visit I was with my parents. They took me to our original house. We were shocked to see that the house is totally destroyed as the other houses of the village. and it's just on roads. We looked for the school, for the mosque, for the family council. All the buildings were totally destroyed and the stones are all around the place of the village.
وتبين لأن هذه الغابة سميت بغابة جنوب أفريقيا حيث زرعت من قبل كيرن كيامت التابعة لجنوب أفريقيا ليهود جنوب أفريقيا.
At that day I found out that the name of that forest is South African Forest because it was built based on the donation came from the Jewish in South Africa, Jewish community in South Africa.
أشكر اللجنة على استقبالنا وترحبتنا.
I would like to thank you very much for listening to us and welcoming us.
Thank you very much. Any other additions? Probably the last, because Anna can come back when you answer questions. Okay.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you. I would like first I want to thank you for your house and for your son. I will continue when Abu Maher here finished the story of his village Lubia, and I will tell you that nowadays there is still 40 villages in the southern part of Israel called the Nakhab, Negev in Hebrew, who are still facing the threat to be demolished and that the population of the villages will be evacuated and moved to towns, townships that the state of Israel built for the Bedouin community in order to concentrate in this area and not in the area we are living nowadays. For example, one of our cases that we are accompanied for the last decade or so is the village of Hatir Umeshran. The people of Hatir Umeshran are living since 1956 in the Wadi Hatir area after they were moved there by a military order since they were under a military regime and after being forced removed from their land back in the Nakba in 1948. So they were moved first to this specific area according to the military order, and now the state is willing to move them again to the township of Hula and to build in their place a new settlement called Hiran and to expand a forest, the Fatir Forest, to be the biggest man-planted forest in the Middle East. And this show us how much the story of Libya and the story of the Nakba and the destroyed villages is not a story of the past, it's not a story of history, it's a continuous policy that is still implemented nowadays. There are 40 villages, as I said, in the Nakba who are threatened and facing the demolition order and evacuation, and we are here to ask the committee in order to prevent the demolition and evacuation of villages in South Israel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your input. I want to introduce now Honorable Nazir Holden. He's a member of parliament, he's not a member of this committee, member of parliament, but he's not serving in this committee. In our parliament, it is allowed that a member can go to any committee just to hear what is happening there. But the procedure is that delegations present to us and then we allow the members to ask questions. Sometimes it's just public speaking questions, sometimes they just make comments. Now we don't make it a question and answer. I'm going to request you to notice the member will say I'm so and so, then you can say a question that came from Honorable Masang, or sometimes just another member just write the question, then you respond to that. It will save our time. I must also tell you something so that when you go out there you don't get surprised. that we get addressed by different political parties and churches, solidarity groups, etc., etc. Now, when you are presenting your matter here, if another group, because in this case what has happened, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies has requested to come and speak to us. It may be the same matter, it may not be the same, but to provide the other side of the story. We're going to meet them at this committee next week on the 14th. And if the PS wants to meet us on the same matter, we'll meet them. If the ambassador of Israel wants to put a different story, we'll meet him or her. If the ambassador of Palestine wants to meet them. Now, don't feel that you'll be betrayed, because Parliament must meet and hear people who don't like each other, who don't agree with each other, and assisting them to agree. That's from our side, we must be heard and appreciate the perspective. I just don't understand that. With that, I want to invite comments from our members. Where we will begin.
Oh, okay. Wakalapa will be the first one. Ora Brahman.
Only one
of them.
Okay, with that, I was noting their hands, you see, and people were speaking to each other. And it was like a meeting to generate. Now, it's over to Honorable Palapa.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just a few questions. Does your organization believe in the two-state solution? And the second one is that what message or programs are you running to try and reconcile the tribes? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Anadakman.
Thanks, Chair. More fact-finding in the country itself is to try and understand, can Muslims and Christians, citizens of Israel, can they own land, can they sit in parliament, can they work in governments, can they travel freely, those sort of things? Sorry, my writing. around the two-state solution, if we were given the two-state solution in a peace deal, where would most of the Palestinians choose to live? Would it be in what would eventually be called before Israel? Would it then be in Palestine? I know that 70 years ago was when most of this happened, but in those days I think there were 1 million Arabs, if I'm not mistaken. How many are there today? In the Israel borders now, what is their life expectancy? What is their education prospects? Now, often in South Africa, we often compare what's happening in Israel in South Africa as an apartheid, as few equal apartheid. And I've always in this committee, I make great plans to explain the difference between the marriage and the divorce. Where I think in Israel, we talk about divorce, and in South Africa, we talk about marriage. But I think you have to speak to Palestinians living in Israel at this stage. And you ask them, I mean, their life expectancy, their education, their GNP per capita. I know that it's higher in Israel than it is in any other country around Israel. So what are the Palestinians in fighting for? Is it to live in Israel, or is it a two-state solution that we speak of? And as my friend says here, I mean, if you look at Syria, there's more Palestinians killed in Syria than there are during any of the wars in Israel. what are we doing? What can we as an international community do to support Palestinians in Syria, for one, let's say? And I think, yeah, I'll ask my questions as well.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mwango.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I imagine that there will be a problem in part of a bigger Palestinian-Israeli question. I would like to know from the delegation what is it that they are doing to actually address the bigger question rather than the Libya, you know, question, because you cannot solve the Libya question without addressing the bigger Israeli-Palestine question. The second one is, I would like to know whether this particular problem around Libya has actually been communicated to the government of Israel. Are they aware of your feelings about it? If so, what are they doing? And the third one is about Arabs in Israel. Do they have political rights? If so, what are those rights? Do they participate in the political life of Israel? And if so, what sort of participation do you have in the political life of Israel?
Thank you very much, Honorable.
Ms. Shopping.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, delegation from Palestine. Your Saraki, Palestine, it's a long Saraki with all my body, and we are feeling pain for your Saraki from Palestine. So now, I think my question will be similar to other members of Parliament. You know, in South Africa, we had similar problems before, in 1994, where we fought apartheid. And then what are you doing in Palestinian? I know that you are lobbying international community and so on, but you as a Palestinian to fight your own family, because you must fight for you to be successful. And the other question that I want to ask to you is that the UN, the role of the UN in Israel, are you looking about it? If you are not happy, what are you doing? And the third and the last question is that over here in South Africa, are we here to visit the South Africa, or are you in a call to visit all African countries to lobby against Israel?
Honorable
Dudley,
thank you. First, just to recognize the organization's efforts in terms of trying to move things forward in line with the shared future, because obviously we all know we have no future anyway, and there's a shared future, and so that's really commendable. I mean, just to talk to some of what we heard and the specifics of your specific problem, what are the processes open to you in Israel? I mean, are you able to access Parliament? I mean, we have processes, democratic processes, how do people know where you would take your grievance, who you would appeal to, what kind of response do you get. So what are the processes like in terms of the democratic processes? And then I have heard some people talking I think mostly from Arabs within Israel, in terms of a constitutional amendment, or at least a constitution in Israel where it actually opened up to just looking at minority rights a little more than what's happening now. And that seems to me a positive way to go in terms of taking a step forward, rather than saying everything's wrong, because I mean, if we look at any country, we'll all agree that's not kind of one of our perfect in any of these things. But those constitutional amendments seem to be something quite positive, particularly in terms of protecting minority rights. Or differently, this country, it put a light, it shone a light on minority rights, whilst of course respecting majority in a democracy. So then, of course, lastly would be just generally as Palestinians within Israel, what can Palestinians do? I mean, organizations from the outside can try to get people's voices heard and try to create a platform. But what can Palestinians themselves do in terms of moving the peace process forward? Because we hear a lot of anger talk and fighting and throwing bricks and blah, blah, blah. But, we, you know, I'm sure that what you really want for your children and your children's children is peace. And some degree of shared future. So do you think that a negotiated peace process, like what we did in South Africa, the Munch Compromise on all sides, if so, what are some of those compromises that the Palestinians might do to move the process forward? Because here in South Africa, it took a huge compromise on all sides.
I mean, everybody was choking at every step of the way, I should imagine. There was nothing funny about the bombardment that were made, but it did take all sides in this. If we can hear your comments on this, thanks.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation by the delegation. I have this question. When you were removed from your original places, would you regard that process as a crime against humanity? And if you do, don't you think it's about time that those atrocities should be taken to the International Criminal Court against the state of Israel? In terms of the rights that you have, especially those who are still in Israel, are your languages recognized? Are they taught in schools? And you say that you were removed from your place of origin. So what is the official version of the Israeli government in terms of how you happened not to be in your way? Thank you.
Honorable Rapoti.
In the last month it was the weekend month where the restriction of the machine had mama and cheese button. The strike a woman, the strike a house. So you can see, you know, the organization is led by women. By law. So thank you very much for your presentation. But you can see that, you know, the reason what you are doing, you are also reflecting on the issue of blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. I think all of us here, we, especially as parliamentarians, will be able to advocate what is truth, what is just, and what is peaceful for everyone. If it's wrong, it's wrong. If it's right, it's right. So here.
Honorable President.
Thank you very much, Jay, and my apology for being late. I was learning about the community, science and technology. But I have heard the presentation on two occasions already, Friday and on Monday evening. And I'm pleased that my gay colleagues were here. They had away from the details just before the lesson, but I can understand why. Now, we all know that...
The point of order is for Spain. Just make your comment, ask for questions.
Thank you very much. It's not in the meeting. We're not in the house.
No. Just make your point.
Thank you very much. We accept, and it's internationally known and accepted that the colonial state of Israel is an apartheid state. We know that. And we as South Africans know what action our government should take when it comes to dealing with an apartheid state. We know as South Africans, those of us that were peace-loving, those of us that believed in justice, we knew what steps the international community had to take in dealing with an apartheid South Africa. So we do know what our government, South African government, should do when it comes to dealing with an apartheid state of Israel. But so we know what Israel is, we know what we should do. But very important, and I think this is the crux of it all, there's nobody asking the Palestinians what do they want. We have some people wanting a two-state solution. We didn't have that in South Africa, we had one state. We were Pakistan here, very much like Gaza and West Bank now. But we integrate them into the greater South Africa. So to go and it is very reactionary to want to come with a two-state solution which will leave us with a Pakistan West Bank and a Pakistan Gaza and this first world Israel, which is a pariah state as well. So I think the crux is here. what do the Palestinians want? And I do believe in peace more than anything else, but I also believe in justice first before peace. We have peace in North Africa, but there's no justice. We have a continuous fight. I do also draw very strong parallels between the current state of Islam, what I've heard from it, about people not being allowed to speak the native language of Arabic. Less than 50 kilometers from here is a school, St. Susie, where girls are fined 10 rand for speaking their native language. So there's a very strong parallel between the Western Cape and the part of Israel. And I experienced it, I was born.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
I want to. No, there's nothing to withdraw, but I want to grant a point of order.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we were approaching this matter in a way that would actually make us understand the problems in Israel. And we were approaching this matter in a way that would actually make us contribute to achieving peace in Israel and between Israel and Palestine. But to come here and be judgmental and take dogmatic positions on the issue, and it actually destroys our chances of actually contributing towards actually making these two people find each other. So, and also to impose your personal views on the committee is wrong, because I may not be subscribing to some of the things that have been said. Thank you.
The
Reverend
Chairman,
Mr. Chairman,
All I want to know is we know that Israel is an apartheid state. We know what we as a government should do.
You said that before.
So, but what I want to know is, what do the Palestinians want in terms of a roadmap going forward to achieving that? That's the most important question. What do we want to impose on them? I don't see that you're an Arab. I see Palestinians. I don't see two different people.
I want to join my colleagues to welcome the presentation that we have made and the views that were expressed and the comments and questions that we are giving to you. I have a few comments and my questions will apply to the president in a particular context. Currently, the South African government, the president, appointed two special envoys, Dr. Zola Zweya and former Deputy Minister Aziz Fahad. Mohalab, we've never allowed people to vote in our meetings. So, I was saying there are two special envoys in the Middle East. Do you know about them? Have you in the people who are that side met them? The two leaders who are making a mediation on behalf of South Africa. And just to explain, this was following they demand that we must withdraw the ambassador of Israel, we must impose sanctions, we must do all those things in South Africa. That, no, we want to engage the state of Israel, and we want to also to engage the different warring parties within Palestine and also Israel. We must engage discussions and negotiations as part of our decision-making in terms of state. Now, the other matter is, this land, this land, Libya, which you say was destroyed, don't know whether you said 1948 or 1967, then you say forest was planted there to decimate the memory of everything there. And then you have said that parts of that land, now the University of Tel Aviv has been built there. Do you want to reclaim that piece of land, or want to reclaim that forest? And that piece of land, which you want to reclaim as Palestinians, is now under an area controlled by Israel. What might happen to that area? Is it going to be under the authority of Palestine or under the authority of Israel? If you get what I mean, and I must explain something here. For example, here in South Africa, we've got a land restitution or land change policy, where people were constantly removed, and then a new town now has taken town where they are. When you say, we were staying here 6 years ago, we say, but there's a new town now, or there's a winery, then we give you a financial compensation, because you can't move the town. What is your view about that? Where something has already been built, would you say it must be destroyed because of what there is? And this matter about the two-state solution is a very important thing to us as a parliament of South Africa, and also from our part. Whether you agree that there must be an existence of the sovereign state of Israel. Because we also ask the government of Israel and the South African Jewish Board and everyone else whether they agree and subscribe to the fact that there must be a sovereign state of Palestine. And with that, then there must be peaceful coexistence. We noted that we've had to ask some civil Hamas and the PLO, where other political organizations wanted other countries to help them destroy the state of Israel, which you can't do in terms of the United Nations. Nor can we, as other countries, agree with Israel that the people of Palestine or the state of Palestine be destroyed. So in other words, the two-state solution, actually peaceful coexistence for the two nations in the same geographical area to be able to develop their languages, their culture, their everything else, etc., etc. And I think this point has been made by my other colleagues. Now, I think Honorable Ayala also asked you whether your matter has been heard by the United Nations. That's Honorable Shope, United Nations. And my last, whether you've gone to the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, where you feel that matters also belong to that. Yeah, I think those are the questions and comments that we have made. Now we'll then hand over to you all. This is Honorable Mbumlwana, Member of Parliament, and a member of this committee, and he wants to ask either a question or he wants to make a comment, then we'll hand over to you. You only have about 50 minutes to answer all the questions.
Thank you. I want to thank you in appreciation. While I was away, I hope that you learned as well. But I just wanted to find out any other question. That's something related to what you have presented.
And that is,
knowing the area and the country you come from, is there a distinction
within Israel. The distinction between the so-called Palestinians, the so-called Israelis. Are they two people? I mean, what we had in Israel, we had one country and two different people being treated differently by the government in terms of the amount money for each side spent on money that is spent on each side. The child of an African getting much less than the child of a white guy. You have a similar thing in Israel. Secondly, do you also have them from staying, you have people staying in the township very much away from the city and to have to travel to the city. Very clear in case on the Kodkaidish and Langa, which is very far from the what is happening. Do you have a similar thing? And I understand there are people who yes,
I left very important question. Are you an NGO or you are a political party or a civil rights movement? How do you define yourself as the main party? Yeah.
Honourable Mesahou, if I may head over to the delegation of Palestinian main questions that honourable members have directed are directed to them, and then if I may take 2 minutes to address the questions from members.
Okay, thank you very much. A lot of topics, I'm not sure that we can cover all of them, but I will start to maybe explain the situation that we live in, and I believe that we will cover most of the points, and if not, we are pleased to continue afterwards. I will start with the question Your Honor asked. We are not politicians. We don't represent any political party. We are NGOs. We are part of the civil society organizations trying to raise human rights issues. And the main focus of our work, as my organization called in Hebrew Zohrot and Adrid and Adala, our main focus in this project, in this visit, is about the return of the internal displaced Palestinians and the Palestinian refugees. All these people have been expelled in 1948, have the right, according to the international law and according to the human rights agreement and according to the United Nations decision 194 that had been decided in 1949 that all the Palestinian refugees can and must return home and live peacefully with their neighbors. And this decision has not been implemented by the State of Israel since then. One more correction, that the village of Lubia today is under the Forest of South Africa, not under the University of Tel Aviv. There's another village called Sheikh Mouanis, also destroyed Palestinian village, is under the University of Tel Aviv, which is the fact that the University of Tel Aviv is built also on a destroyed Palestinian village, but it's not this case, it's another case. The question of, yeah, I can repeat that if you want. Well, South Africa Forest, as we said, because the money came to the JNF who planted the trees on the village of Lubia, the most of the money as designed sale in the forest came from the Jewish community in South Africa, as we mentioned before. During the events of 1948 that we described in Arabic as Nakba, most of the Palestinian people forced to leave its homeland inside the borders of the State of Israel, and then some of the Palestinians remained and stayed in their villages and places for different reasons and became minority inside the State of Israel. So when we talk about rights of minorities, we are not normal minorities. We have been minoritized by force, by expulsion, and by ethnic cleansing actions by the State of Israel and the Zionist movement in 1948. A little bit before, a little bit after. So when we talk about just and about peaceful vision in our country, we do believe, first of all, on the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. Of course, it will influence the landscape and the demographic situation in the country. But we do believe that Palestinians and Jewish could live together in an equal state, equal place, under the justice, a system of justice, not under a system of racism or just. By the way, the state of Israel is by definition a racist state because it's defined as Jewish state. We are not Jewish, we are part of the state. So automatically this state says to us, it's not your state, it's only a Jewish state. We believe that state should be for the whole citizens and all the citizens supposed to be equal. So the question if this will be Israel or not, it's not relevant because we want to build up a democratic, real democratic state that Jews and others could live equally in the same state and the same system. By the way, when the states, the face of oppressions or occupations, in the process of justice and peace, they could change their names, they could update their definitions, they could change their flags and symbols. This is what we as Palestinians need to build up with the Jewish community who are already living in our place. If the Israeli educational system learning the events of the Palestinian Nakba and what happened to the Palestinians during 1948, no, for the Israeli students in the Israeli schools, these events for them is an independence war. They don't say what happened to the Palestinian population in Palestine at 1948. They don't say what happened to the Palestinian localities, towns and cities and culture that used to be in Palestine for hundreds of years. All these had been expelled and destroyed by the state of Israel and erased from the landscape. They changed the identity of the place in order to make it a Jewish place, an Israeli place. And we complain, of course, for that because we feel that our identity lost because of the policy of the state of Israel is unjust actions and actions of violence and oppression against our nation and against our identity. The decisions of the United Nations making the situation very complicated. That's correct, the United Nations acknowledged the state of Israel. We believe that this acknowledgement actually blocking the way for justice for the Palestinian when it is acknowledgement in the situation of the situation today. Because the United Nations had contradiction in their decisions in one side, it calls for the return of the Palestinian refugees, and at the same time they acknowledge a Jewish state. But, as I said before, we don't want to create an apartheid state to have a majority of Palestinians, a minority of Jews. We want just state that respect all citizens, regardless their religions or their colors or their ethnic belongings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hagi.
I wanted to answer about the
one question. Okay. Philistine?
Yes. Just one note that just to make it clear that we are here, either it's a one-state solution or a two-state solution or a solution. We are here for human rights issues, and we are here for the pain of the people who are living 2-3 kilometers away from their village in the same, and they can't go back to these villages and live there. And for the people who are being threatened nowadays to be demolished and evacuated from their places. As for living inside Israel, many questions were raised about our rights and the political rights and so on. Yes, we have political rights. We can vote and have to participate in the political elections. But still, the state we are facing discrimination in so many levels that I can name three levels that will maybe explain the whole picture. In the level of laws, the laws that we managed to classify 60 laws that are discriminatory laws against the Arabs inside Israel.
50.
You can find these, we have a database of these laws and how they are by definition are discriminatory laws. In addition to these laws, there are many laws and many policies that are implemented in a discriminatory way. And we have many cases that can explain how, for example, there are discrimination in the budgeting of municipalities, Arab municipalities and Jewish municipalities. It's not written there that the Jews will get, the municipalities will get more money. But in fact, though, when it's going in fact, and how the criteria are made, this is the situation and this is the result that that we get. In addition to that,
conclusion, please. I have a meeting.
Okay, I'll finish here and literally. Thank you.
Heidi.
To very, very briefly respond to a couple of the honourable members' questions, we are an association of civil society. We are specifically committed for people in the area to come to the terms of the terms of their own political and other future, whatever that solution looks like. So we feel very strongly about not dictating our solution. We also would like to raise awareness that as South African Jews, that there are human rights abuses perpetrated in our name, as we, but also generally as South Africans, that there is a place for South Africa. So I just want to talk about what that means. And finally, just to say that we are also committed to building relations with Jewish Israelis who are involved in bringing this history into public consciousness, because it's only through acknowledgement of great injustice that any kind of solution can come beyond political rhetoric into building relations between communities and communities and translating reality. Thank you very much to this committee for your time.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for your presentation. I would like to raise you. We still have just one item to dispose of. Committee staff are not funded. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you very much.
Honourable members, under announcement, we said we have got something on the foreign service bill as well as the proposed status quo. Are you able to speak to the fact? Maybe let me just maybe faster presentation.
Yeah.
We've got the foreign service bill, and it was published and each time it expired. But the problem that we encountered was that the responses of the input were very few. And I subsequently spoke to the chair of chairs, honorable colleague, to ask for an advertisement. He felt that it was going to be expensive. So rather let's open the deadline and allow for people to make input. Of course, we did say to him, we think that we can use radio stations, we can use interviews in the different radio stations, but the interviews in our own indigenous languages, like Xhosa, Zulu, etc. Then we can use speaker's notes. And we can also target certain universities and certain NGOs and say, you, IGG, you, there are institutions that are based in the universities. That we can say, let them say something about the foreign service bill.
and individual. So the purpose of Food Type 2. So the deadline has been extended to October. Yeah. And with that, I've asked Abosu Dineo to draft a proposal for us about how we could embark on the study board. So they've not been able to come back with the quantification the cost. Because if you say, for instance, 7 committee members travel from here to Algeria, to Canada, to the UN, you're going to be a study for on the bill at the same time and oversight. So with oversight, we also have to do it. So that we can benchmark with other countries that have similar legislation, Canada, Algeria, something like that. Or it can be other countries. Now, I have spoken to some of the people on the other side, but the problem for now is that it is not qualified. We're not able to go to them and say it will cost 1 million or it will cost 30,000. And so many people do that. We must do that so that when we write an application to one of the colleague and subsequently to the speaker, all those things must be put in and the proposed date. They are waiting on that.
In order for the committee to be able to get as much input as possible on the bill before it's finalized, we propose to the committee to hold a seminar during the oversight period in Victoria on the 22nd of September, so that we can attract as many stakeholders, as many such people, and as many different types of society as possible, in order to at least be able to get more input into the system.
Is that your question? That it will not necessarily be something that we can do that in the
It's meant to be part of the process of gathering. It's not yet an official public hearing. So it's one process which, among other processes which we can use in order to get to cross input. The public hearings will be coming later after the deadline of October.
Because you talked about Algeria, Canada and the UN. Now, I don't have a problem with the UN. But given that we are a member of BRICS, and I know what I'm going to talk about is actually going to work out differently. But for me, it could have been good if we were split members of the committee. I'm not sure if you will allow that. Alas, this is Canada, Algeria, and the UN. Others visit China, India, and something like that. Because you've got to look at similar legislation in countries within the British community and countries within the Western sphere. You see, I'm not sure if you, the very legislations themselves have not been brought to us for discussion. These ones are about following advantages and disadvantages and within the British community, but it may well be for us who are left leaning ideologically.
Should we push the envelope too far? I don't think Parliament is quite up to doing those two narratives. And maybe we can. Depending on your negotiations, we can check it. But we are not bound to satisfy the bridge unless it's for oversight. Unless it's for oversight and approach, which we should do, I agree. But in this situation, we're looking for the best, but which is first way, why not? But bridge oversight is.
Which is overall about that, I was saying there are other questions, like the seminar that we are going to have. The committee, we are also thinking the committee should have video conferences in different countries. That will allow us more, you know, consultation with different countries that we cannot physically be there because of the cost. And if the chair wants to pursue that one, if the committee, then, but video conferencing will be another option because that can be done. Because we still have talk to Philippines, we still have talk. There are so many other countries which we, including the BRICS and some in Africa, where we will not be able to physically be present, but we can have video conferencing with them, have the community, in order to have cost. It's another way of doing it.
Can you react to this?
Yes. Can I suggest that the chair, we can visit to those countries that we think would be benefiting to consult with them. Then once we have those countries, then they will split to say, this one must be visited, this one must be done so we do.
Okay. In fact, let them bring another developed and optional countries and their own legislation around us. This side, and then the other side, then at the seminar, or someone next to you, we can because what is going to happen next week after the president has answered the question, many members are sent for Victoria to sleep there, and then in the morning we have a meeting with the South African
Commission
or deputy in the morning. Then after that, then we are going to have a meeting with their office. We are going to oversight this spoken about that, which may be quite difficult all the time. So it's part of our committee. That's the arrangement for us. Now, why is it not when we are that side? Because it's going to be hard to be when we are that side, then you will think they will propose us. For these other countries besides the countries decide countries for video conferencing and so on and so on. Then number can speak to us. Is it sitting one with you?
I think. To put together the application. I'm expecting them this afternoon. And also traveling to Pretoria will also be dependent on approval by the House Chairperson. But as soon as we get approval, we will communicate the logistics to members. Okay, thank you, sir. Yes.
It's all legal, but the thing is, what is the time frame? If you were to tell me, you know, if you're going to get approval and I get approval next Monday, it would fit my work and my anxiety and, you know, what I can and can't do. So I think that we should at least, you know, by close of business tomorrow have an idea. Otherwise, if committee is not sitting, I can go back to my constituency. If it fits my anxiety and so really,
if you succeed, we can't have a back tomorrow afternoon. Yes, I agree. We can forgive you because you were preparing for the game, for this meeting. But beyond this point, members must know. You know, they must also decide whether they will be going or they're not going, where they're sleeping, what. The whole program. Because this program must be attached to the letter that will be sent there. And we're not spoken to them. Can I again?
Yes, sir.